I was told once, David, that reputation is something that people see about you. Character is something they never see. It's something that's within us. Is that pretty accurate?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I actually think people assume that they see our character by what we do, by our reputation, and I think people confuse those a lot in reality. And we put these labels on people. You know, we assume someone who we label as good is incapable of doing a bad thing, and if they do something bad, well, then we think, well, you know what, they must have been a wolf in sheep's clothing all along. But what the book tries to show is that we, you know, we see celebrities, we see politicians, we see these crazy stories on the news all the time. And we point to these people when trying to, in the book, tell you what psychological processes may have, you know, underlied, you know, whether it's Elliot Spitzer or Anthony Weiner or whoever it may be, but also how these same processes can trip individuals up, any of us.
Don't they realize, most of these people now, that, and we're talking about all kinds of folks that are not publicly known, folks that are publicly known, but the people who are publicly known, David and Carlo, don't they understand the ramifications behind their awesome responsibility because they are under a microscope all the time? Why are they so reckless, Carlo?
Well, I think you're exactly right. They do understand the ramifications, but the processes that drive them towards bad behavior are so strong that it overwhelms their actions, even though they know full well what the consequences might be. And that's why I think the studies that we talk about in the book are so compelling, because even when you know how bad the behavior that you're about to engage in is, you still do it.
Well, and they do it. Is it because they put themselves above other people, above the law, or do they just think, hey, I'm just a regular person?
Well, you know, power has and status are one thing that exacerbate many of the effects we'll talk about. So we talk about the studies, we'll tell you, you know, how these same processes can drive any of us to behave in you know, ways that we're not proud of sometimes, or ways that may be better than we ever imagined. But one thing we do know is that the more power or status somebody has, the more invulnerable you feel, the more you feel like your actions are not going to come back to bite you because everybody loves you. Of course, that's an illusion, but I think that also feeds into why we see it more with some politicians and celebrities.
Let's talk a little bit, David, if you can, about the methods that you and Carlo used as you got the research to write the book Out of Character. How did you do this?
Sure. Well, one thing that Carlo and I strongly believe in is if you're going to study people's moral behavior, you can't simply ask them, what would you do, right? If I said to you, George, would you ever, you know, lie, cheat, or steal? You'll probably say no, and most people would say no. And I don't think they're lying. I think they actually believe it. The problem is, what we argue in the book, is that to really understand what people are going to do, you have to put them in a situation where those temptations are real. You can't make them predict. You've got to see what happens. And so we set up situations that offer people the opportunities to cheat, offer people the opportunities to help others, and we try and understand what subtle forces tip them one way or the other.
Well, you know what? That's absolutely correct, too. I think that's a good way of going about it. Did you categorize it by events, and do you look at events to determine their character? I mean, case in point, somebody steals money that you leave on a table. Somebody has an affair and he's married. You know, somebody cheats in school on a test. Do you categorize them, or are they all thrown in? They're all the same.
Well, one thing that I think comes directly from our studies is that it's particularly hard to categorize people, or harder than most people think. So the common sense intuition is that when someone takes the money off the table, or when someone cheats on their partner, then they're a bad person. They fall into this immoral category. But what we show in our studies consistently is that normal people, people who you otherwise wouldn't put in one category or the other, are capable of engaging in both bad and good actions. So categorization is a tricky endeavor when it comes to character.
Well, and what is the category of a bad person? What makes a bad person? What's the definition of a bad person?
Well, I think, you know, we have to judge people by their actions. The problem is that we have this view that if a good person does something wrong, then they must have been bad all along. So, you know, we'll give you an example. You know, Mark Sanford was the South Carolina governor who a few years back, whether you like his politics or not, everybody agreed that he was a morally upstanding guy. And then we find out that he was, you know, lying to everyone when he said he was on the Appalachian Trail and he was off having this torrid affair. And everybody assumes, well, he must have been a bad guy all along. But then there's an example of, let me give you another one, this gentleman called Farron Hall, who lives under a bridge in Winnipeg, and he's an alcoholic and a drug addict. He jumped in the Red River twice to actually save someone at, you know, great cost to himself. And that one good act, we suddenly don't think, well, he must be, you know, a sheep in wolf's clothing, right? He really was a good guy all along. We don't think that. And so really what Carlo and I want to argue is that people's behavior will make you think that they're a good or a bad person, but we can't put a categorical label on them that it's just because you've done things in the past that maybe are not very virtuous. It doesn't mean that you're not capable of virtue. And similarly, those of us who, you know, think that we are quite good people, we have to get beyond the view that we're not going to be tempted and be able to give in to those temptations.
Well, and you say it's not good versus evil. So if it's not, then what is it? What's behind this kind of behavior?
Yeah, so I think one of the important messages from the book is that we're not trying to tell people what's good and what's bad. So we're not seeing the competing psychological processes as good and evil. Instead, we like to think of it as short-term versus long-term interests. So some recent psychological research coming out from our lab as well as other people's labs have shown that competing mechanisms in the mind look out for our short-term as well as our long-term interests. But these interests often conflict and put us in situations where we need to choose one or the other. And this fight can determine our moral behavior.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it doesn't make sense, evolutionarily speaking, to assume the mind has evil mechanisms unless we're talking about minds that are clearly pathological. What's the purpose in that? Really, social life is all about maximizing what's good for me in the here and now versus what's good for me in the long term, right? If I take the money from you in the here and now, I'm ahead. But if I keep doing that, no one's going to want to interact with me. And so it's about balancing those two pressures.
Are they all hypocrites? These people, do they all say one thing and do another?
Well, you know, I think it's a good question. And we, I think, have some research that suggests that we're all capable of hypocrisy. And, you know, the way that we do this, again, is to put people to the test. So let me give you an example.
Sure.
We run studies where we bring people into the lab, make a long story short, and we tell them, look, there are two tasks that need to be done. One is kind of short and fun. One is really long and onerous. And, you know, we don't care who does which one. We don't want to bias anything, so we're not going to assign people. Here's a coin. Please flip this coin. That's the fair thing to do to see which one you get. And whichever one you don't get, the next person will get. And then we leave. Now, of course, we can watch the people on hidden video. And what do they do? Now, these are just normal college students. 90% of the people do not flip the coin. They simply assign themselves the good task. And if you ask them later, how fairly did you act? They say, oh, you know, it was okay. I did fine. But the interesting part is that if you take these people and have them watch somebody else do the same thing, they will royally condemn them for it. And so right there, you see all of us are willing to engage in the action and to justify it for ourselves and ready to just condemn the next person who does it.